So about those tribes, there was around 570, during shortly after the death of Justinian, a man was born in a place called Mecca among the Arab tribes, and he changed the world. So next slide, please. Muhammad, and images of Muhammad are at a very minimum controversial, all right? So let's keep that in mind. For the most part, Muslims ban images of Muhammad of any sort, positive, negative, otherwise. And this is why cartoons about Muhammad have caused so much uproar and a lot of people to be killed over the last 25 years. This on the left is actually an Islamic image that is common today of Muhammad. There are some slivers of the Muslim world where depicting Muhammad is considered to be okay, and this is the image that is routinely used. Historically, no way of knowing whether there's any accuracy to it at all. This is actually a 19th century woodcut that is based on what people in Europe thought of Muhammad going back to the 15th century or so. But very little is actually known specifically about what Muhammad looked like or any of that. But he's born around 570. He was an Arab from Mecca, and he got himself into business and became the manager of, as a young man, became the manager of a rich widow's economic affairs and ran her trading company, which ran camel caravans and other stuff like that. The woman Khadija was about 40, and when Muhammad was about 25, she decided that he was a trustworthy, honorable man admirable and had served her very well. And in the culture of the time, she almost never saw him directly. He didn't report to her. He reported to people that worked for her. But he was her principal economic guy and the guy that handled most of her money and that sort of stuff. So she sent him a note via one of her ladies proposing marriage, and he accepted, even though she was at least 15 years older than him. And they were married for some 25 years, pretty happily. Having married a rich widow, Muhammad had some time on his hands. And he began to take spiritual retreats into a cave on a hillside not that far from Mecca. And so he would go into the cave to listen for the voice of God and to pray. And eventually he began to hear voices in there. And so a voice came to him, which he eventually attributed to an angel, perhaps the angel Gabriel, with the call to recite or to read or to speak, depending on the translation and the way that it's handled. But there's a fair amount of back and forth about what shall I recite or what shall I read. It is unlikely that Muhammad was actually a literate man. He probably knew how to keep some numerical statistics to run the thing that he did, but unlikely that he actually could read and write. It was very much an oral culture that he came up in, a culture of storytelling where people told stories and other people listened very closely and learned the stories so that they could tell them too. And so he came back and reported to his wife that he'd been spoken to by an angel in the cave, and the angel was giving him these messages, and she became a believer in this thing that he called Islam. and was the first convert to that. And for a number of years, the only people that he told this to were members of his extended family. But he eventually began to preach this in a broader way. This caused huge controversy in Mecca, which was a very pagan society, primarily because although he was from one of the larger, more important families, he was not a major part of that family. Mecca's one claim to fame at the time was a black rock called the Kaaba that people from across Arabia made pilgrimages to come engage in pagan worship of this black rock that was said to have fallen from the sky, been thrown down by God. There was a lot of pushback in Mecca about this thing that Muhammad was doing. But this is a case where an individual creates a new faith. And it appears that what Muhammad was really trying to do was create something parallel, that he had some familiarity, some knowledge of some basics about Judaism and about Christianity. There was a significant Jewish community in Arabia at the time. And most of the Christian texts that appear to have come his way are Gnostic things. The Gospel of James and some of the infancy Gospels and things like that. And so they're texts which are not biblical, but which have a lot of focus on Jesus and Mary and Mary's role and that sort of thing. And so he seems to have used Christianity and Judaism as reference points, and he was fascinated by the story of Ishmael. And Abraham had two sons, and from Isaac you get the Jews, and Ishmael is sent into the desert, into exile. And so Muhammad became convinced that the children of Ishmael, that Ishmael is the father of the Arab tribes, the people of the desert, and that therefore the Arabs are descended from Abraham and they are part of the same family as Abraham, just as Jews and Christians by extension are, and that we are therefore all people of the book. And he saw himself as a reformer. You know, the church is always reforming. He saw himself as a reformer, that he was reforming the church. That he was reforming the church from within by providing a story that the Arab peoples would be drawn into the faith. And so he began to preach that he was the keeper of the one true faith, the one true faith that Adam had followed, the one true faith that Abraham had followed, the one true faith that Moses had followed, the one true faith that Jesus had followed, that now Muhammad was the prophet that God was using to share this one true faith. And that Christians and Jews had gone off track and had lost the thread of what the one true faith was. And so he proclaimed Islam as the one true faith and his role as the restorer. And the Quran, became the collection of the things that he had said, a book of words to recite. And he received a series of revelations. He went to the cave from time to time and received revelations by a wide variety of other means. And more than a few of the revelations that he received were rather pretty conveniently timed. He received a revelation on the eve of a battle or at a moment where he needed to make a personnel decision or where he needed to choose something. And he received a revelation that helped him to make this choice or to justify what he was going to do. Since it's a society with an oral tradition, He spoke these things orally, and his earliest believers were all people who whose job it was to, when Muhammad came and said, "This is the message I received," it was their job to memorize it immediately and then to repeat it over and over again. And so the Quran is the accumulated set of the revelations that Muhammad had received, orally transmitted, orally passed down, but memorized by people who heard it from Muhammad and passed down by them. And so then assembled and actually written down after Muhammad's death. After Muhammad's death, there was not an immediate move to write this stuff down because there were all these people who had heard it from Muhammad and who were regarded as the keepers of the flame. But a bunch of them were killed in various circumstances, primarily in some battles. And as a result of that, it became imperative to write this down before they were all dead. But Muhammad was a religious leader who quickly became a political leader and a military leader. When I was in middle school a long, long time ago, my local newspaper published a thing about the 100 most impactful and influential people in the history of the world. And as you know, as an unbeliever, I was interested in this in the abstract, who's on your list. But the thing I remember about the list was they made Muhammad number one. And their argument was that Muhammad was number one because Jesus was just a religious leader. And Muhammad was a religious leader and a military leader and a political leader. And so that he's across the spectrum, and that makes him more significant, more successful, more important, which of course assumes that the stuff that he had to say was true. In any case, Muhammad is persecuted and driven out of Mecca. You know, he flees from there, goes to Medina, a nearby city, and returns a decade later and conquers Mecca fairly bloodlessly and becomes the new ruler. And part of what he does in order to do this was to explain to the Meccans that pagan worship, pagan pilgrimages to Mecca are wrong, but that all Muslims, all those who follow Islam, will also have to make a pilgrimage to Mecca and come to worship at the holy rock that fell from the sky, just as the pagans did before, but now it will be an Islamic thing, and as Muslims we will do this. And so the pilgrimages will continue, and the economic things that you get out of this will continue. That made people in Mecca a lot more interested in joining his thing. But when Muhammad dies in 632 AD, he is in his 60s. He has some 40 or 50,000 followers, and almost all of them are in Arabia. He has managed to convert the larger part of the Arabian tribes. And he is putting together an initiative to send an army to invade Syria because he views Byzantine Syria as weak and as open for conquest, and is thinking about what he should do about this. Muhammad was apparently faithful to his wife Khadijah for 15 or so years until her death. After her death, he married 12 other women, plus or minus. There's some controversy about the numbers and about who. With all but one exception, the women that he married were widows or were women that there was a political reason to marry them. He He seems to have largely married women that there was an economic or political reason in order to do so, and where he believed that it was good for them. The one exception to that is the hugely controversial wife, Aisha. Aisha was somewhere between 9 and maybe 19 when she married Muhammad, who was pushing 60. The people that say that she was closer to 19 are people that are very pro-Muhammad on this and don't have almost any background information. It is likely that she was 9 or 10 or maybe 12 years old. But she became a big person in the Islamic movement after the death of Muhammad. She was apparently pretty smart and got herself pretty well educated along the way. And for the rest of her life, spent a lot of time focused on, you know, I saw Muhammad do this, I saw Muhammad do that, Muhammad was like this when he did these things, which caused people to constantly come and consult with her about what he said and what he did. So next slide. So the Quran. So I there's people from time to time that are always looking to talk about. Let's compare the Quran and the Bible. And I want to argue to you that the Quran doesn't really compare to the Bible in any very useful way. So I added a third book here to this comparison because I think it's a much better comparison with the Quran than the Bible is. That is, the Quran and the Book of Mormon have in common that they each have a single author, that they each claim some fulfilled prophecy, but basically the fulfilled prophecy in both cases is that it exists, kind of, that the book itself exists. They claim some miracles, but there's no other reason to see those or to believe those. And there's some parallels in the way that they think of the world. Both the Book of Mormon and the Quran struggle a little bit with what's the story really about elements of this. You know, the Bible is a beginning and an end. You know, Genesis. Genesis is beginnings. Revelation is an apocalypse. It's an ending. The Bible, there's a beginning and there's an end. And there's a narrative arc from the beginning to the end. And there's a deeper story. 66 books, 40 authors, all these different fulfilled prophecies down through the ages, some 1,600 years that this is written and assembled over. But salvation by grace through faith in Jesus Christ is the underlying thing that is the story all the way along. And all the pieces point to this. You know, you read the Old Testament prophets, and they point to salvation by grace through faith in Jesus Christ. You know, and that's not something that was necessarily apparent to those who were writing those books or who were hearing those words when those prophets spoke. A year ago, with the teens, we did the book of Micah, and Micah has stuff about the coming Savior. And it points to salvation by grace through faith in Jesus Christ. So the Bible's written in two or three languages, depending on how you look at this. The Quran is written only in a very classic Arabic. In fact, there are many people today and down through the ages who believe that the Quran is legitimate only in that Arabic. That is, translations of the Quran are widely believed by Muslims to not be legitimate expressions of that word. Okay? We believe the Bible is the word of God translated into every tongue around the world. And so Bible translation is a thing that we do. It's a thing that we invest in. It's a thing that we are part of. Get this word into every tongue, that every tribe and nation may come to know him. But Muslims generally believe that the Quran is actually the Quran only in the classic Arabic. And so that translating it in other languages is a little bit dodgy from a theological perspective. So, and of course, Joseph Smith says that, you know, the Book of Mormon is translated from golden plates that were written in something called Reformed Egyptian, which is a language that no one else has ever heard of and that there is no other evidence for. But that, you know, God gave him this revelation. So both Joseph Smith as the author of the Book of Mormon and Muhammad as the guy who received the visions that are eventually written down in the Quran are guys that saying, look, an angel spoke to me and gave me a message to get to transmit to everyone else, and I am basically the only witness to this. Which is really different than a lot of the ways that the biblical authors engage the world and think about things. So the Book of Mormon, by the way, is primarily the story of some of the lost tribes of Israel, sort of. Joseph Smith has people leaving Jerusalem shortly before the Babylonian conquest, and traveling across Arabia and getting on ships and ending up in North America. So anyway, the details of that are a little difficult to work out, the lost tribes, of course, are people that were taken away by the Assyrians before that, but in any case, the Book of Mormon is based on the idea that Jewish people fled Jerusalem and came to North America and are the ancestors of the American Indians. And this was a big thing in the early 19th century, the idea that the American Indians were somehow descended from the Jews. This was a thing, there were a number of novels and a lot of stories that were going around, and so Joseph Smith, you know, built on that. Muhammad is really building on the idea that we need a gospel for the Arabs. The Arabs need their own thing. And so we're going to create a thing that ties the Arabs in. So you know, Jesus is, you know, in the Bible, Jesus is the Son of Jesus Christ, is the Messiah, the Son of God, the incarnate Word, the Savior, the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords. In the Quran, he is a prophet, and the Quran specifically rejects that Jesus was crucified. The Quran specifically rejects the idea that Jesus is crucified, and specifically says that couldn't have happened. They must have gotten the wrong person and crucified somebody else. If he was God's prophet, he could not have been crucified. And that's in keeping with a lot of the Gnostic writings that were common in the couple of centuries before Muhammad was born. But the Quran affirms the Torah, affirms the prophets, affirms the Gospels, but then kind of runs off in a different direction. Moses is the character that shows up the most often in the Quran. Moses is quoted repeatedly saying a lot of stuff that he doesn't say in the Old Testament, but saying some stuff that he does. And Mary appears a lot more often in the Quran than she does in the New Testament. And Jesus appears often, but as a prophet who is a precursor to Muhammad. One of the challenges about the Quran, if you've tried to read it, is, you know, not only is there no narrative arc, but there's really no storyline at all. The 114 surahs of the Quran are freestanding elements that could be read in any order, because they, although there is some of them are clearly earlier and some of them are clearly later in Muhammad's life, they don't have a timeline, a chronology that really fits together. And the 114 stories, most of them are not about any one thing. They are kind of mishmashy. They have a lot of different elements put into them. So it does engage with various incidents, and it's very focused on, you know, the idea there's one God and that there is the last day is coming when judgment is coming. But the Quran is about a distant and unknowable God who demands obedience from you and who may or may not actually give you any grace as a result of that. That he does what he will, and you need to rigorously fulfill his various key requirements and hope that will be good enough. The Quran kind of assumes that you're familiar with all kinds of other stuff. It refers to events without actually narrating them or laying out what happened. It talks about disagreements without laying out what specifically was being disagreed about. It refers to people and places obliquely without specifically naming them. And so the Quran is really difficult to get at and to... As something to read, it's a project. Muslims believe that it is a brilliant work of early Arabic literature, but that's true only in the original. That in translations, you lose the magic. You lose the thing that makes it great. Now, some people who know the ancient Arabic really well and study this sort of stuff say that in the original, every fourth or fifth sentence makes no sense at all, that a lot of it is kind of random and thrown together and very difficult to understand. In any case, but these are, I would argue that it's a lot easier to compare the Quran with the Book of Mormon than it is to compare it with the Bible. And it's really not fair to the Quran to compare it to the Bible. The Bible is really on a wholly different level than the Quran. And it's important to keep that in mind. As a side note on the Book of Mormon, Mark Twain read the Book of Mormon, and this is what Mark Twain had to say about the Book of Mormon early on when it was relatively new. Mark Twain says, quote, "The author labored to give his words and phrases the quaint, old-fashioned sound and structure of our King James translation of the scripture. And the result is a mongrel, half modern glibness and half ancient simplicity and gravity. The latter is awkward and constrained, the former natural, but grotesque by the contrast. Whenever he found his speech growing too modern, which is about every sentence or two, he ladled in a few such scriptural phrases as exceeding sore, and it came to pass, etc., and made things satisfactory again. And it came to pass was his pet. If he had left that out, his Bible would have only been a pamphlet." Anyway. So there's Mark Twain on the Book of Mormon. One more slide, and we won't go through all this. But the Arab tribes who, in the age of Justinian, were regarded as of no strategic consequence, proceeded to conquer much of what Justinian had conquered and to overrun much of what had been the empire, and did so in a whirlwind. Within 80 years after the death of Muhammad, and at the death of Muhammad, the Muslims were all in Arabia, but within 80 years thereafter, the Muslims had conquered most of what had been the Roman Empire. And this was regarded by most in the church as a catastrophe that was unprecedented down through the ages. So we'll talk about that next time and what that means and how people responded to that. So next slide. Last time we got into this the Islamic conquest. This is the great for many people in the church. This was the gigantic catastrophe of the 7th and into the 8th centuries when Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, the guy who wrote the Quran, the guy who said, you know, I've received these messages in visions and through angels, primarily in the cave outside of Mecca, but then in many other places as he went forward. When he died in AD 632, he had succeeded in unifying most of Arabia. And that is this orange area here on this map. The coastal area along the Red Sea, the Hejaz, and into Yemen, the area of Mecca and Medina, was the core of the area that Muhammad had gained control of. And Muhammad is important because he is not just a religious leader, he's also a political and military leader. In fact, he worked very hard to fuse those three elements together so that the religious, the political, and the military were not entirely distinguishable from one another. And he designed a way of thinking where one leader was really supposed to cover all three of those roles. He played all three of those roles. But when he died in AD 632, he was planning an invasion of Syria, which he thought was relatively ripe for conquest, which was part of the Eastern Roman Empire, what we think of as a Byzantine Empire. But he died before that happened. However, his successors over the next 30 years engaged in one of the great acts of conquest in all of history. In three decades, they conquered Syria, which is a significant province of the Eastern Empire here, what we now think of as a Byzantine Empire, conquered Damascus, took Jerusalem, conquered most of the Sassanid Persian Empire of the day, basically destroyed the Persian Empire and overran almost all of its territory, conquered the rest of Arabia, the territory between the Hejaz and Oman, and then conquered Egypt and moved into North Africa, moved across North Africa all the way to Tripoli. So this was a gigantic amount of conquest. They even came up with a small navy and went and conquered Cyprus. And so this is the heart of the area, of course, that Judaism is associated with, in the heart of the first century church. In this 30 years, Antioch, Jerusalem, Alexandria, Edessa, most of the key locations in the first century church that are not actually in Anatolia or Europe are conquered in this period of time, this relatively quick period of time. And so in three decades, a gigantic change here that happens. This is sort of the whirlwind. And in this, we see the collapse of the church in the Middle East and North Africa as sort of the principal social and political force, which it has been for the previous two centuries. The church itself does not go away. As a religious institution, churches remain open. Believers continue to worship. But the church goes from the primary influence on government and on society to outsider status in a very quick order. And within 80 years, less than a century of the death of Muhammad, much more than half of the ancient Roman Empire and almost all of the ancient Persian Empire is conquered by Islamic forces. And there's an underlying plan. There's not much written evidence for what was going on, but the Islamic forces that conquered Jerusalem, it was not long after they did this that they built the Dome of the Rock Mosque. So they came with some intent. They came with the intent of establishing certain things, of building certain things, of putting down roots. And this is an advance that continues for basically a century. The Islamic forces continue to spread across North Africa through the Maghreb, what is now Tunisia and Algeria and Morocco, across the Strait of Gibraltar, into what is now Spain and Portugal, and conquer pretty much all of Iberia, and then eventually cross the Pyrenees on what may actually be more raids than conquests, but with a large army, they drive all the way into northern France in AD 732, a century after the death of Muhammad. There's a great battle at Tours or Poitiers, some people call it, where the Muslim forces are in the west are defeated by a guy named Charles Martel. And Martel is a nickname. It means the hammer. And Charles Martel was a very, very effective military leader. And he his victory at Tours ends the Muslim attempt to conquest anything north of the Pyrenees Mountains that divide what is now Spain from what is now France. So, but that century has been a century of continual advance and continual conquest throughout that time. And until Charles Martel, there is no leader on the western side that has had significant success. The Muslim forces have actually driven across now Anatolia into within sight of Constantinople itself. And really the only reason that they've withdrawn is not because they experienced a great military defeat, but because they decided that they didn't have the means to conquer Constantinople yet. And so they withdrew out of Anatolia. But other than that, there's no great defeat until Charles Martel at Tours in 732. And that's all the way in northern France, which is a long way from Mecca. So this is a century of ongoing conquest and advance for the Arab Muslim forces. Now, after Charles Martel, it'll be another seven centuries that the Muslim forces in the east will continue to battle across Anatolia with the intent of conquering Constantinople, which they will do 720 years later. But for that 720 years, there will be advance and retreat, the destruction of much of Anatolia, and the Muslim forces will kind of keep coming. And the perception of people in Constantinople and elsewhere is the war never ends and these guys just keep coming. And even after the fall of Constantinople in 1453, it will be another more than 200 years that Muslim forces continue to push in up through the Balkans and eventually twice besiege the city of Vienna. And so so from a military perspective, this is gigantic as a geopolitical kind of thing, influencing the way that people think about nations, is a huge impact on people. And it creates in the church, in this through this area, the sense that we are constantly under attack and we are constantly losing ground. This becomes a great concern for people in the church. Now, the Arab-Muslim strategy here is actually pretty well thought out. There is a target Syria because we think it's weak, which turns out to be true. Target the Persian Empire because we think it's a shell and it will fall pretty easily. It has been significantly weakened. And one of the reasons why Syria is weak and the Persian Empire is so weak is the Persian Empire and the Eastern Roman Empire have spent most of the last century in a series of wars that at the end of them, they ended up basically back where they started. And so gigantic amounts of blood and treasure have been expended, and nothing has been accomplished that lasts for any period of time. And as a result, the armies are much smaller, the resources that are available are much smaller. Many, many things have been destroyed. Many fortresses have been reduced to rubble. And so the defenses are not available, and the resources to push back are not really available. And so the fruitlessness of the wars between the Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantines, and the Persian Empire, the Sassanids, has created a place where both are significantly weakened, and that provides an opportunity for the Arab Muslim forces. And so they subsequently push across North Africa, use this as a springboard to get into Europe, continue to press Constantinople from the east. And tactically, really, their focus, they are really the first to think that the point of war is not to capture territory. The point of war is to destroy the armies of the other gods. If you can destroy the armies of the other gods, the territory is free to take. And so their focus becomes, how do we confront and destroy the armies of the powers that we are arrayed against? And one of the things that had become true for some centuries was that there was a sense that in warfare, you should get to a point where somebody had won, and then you should basically stop, you should make an agreement, and then you should, move around, give some territory up, etc. And the Muslim forces thought that this was a dumb idea because it allowed the losers to retain significant military capability. So part of their thing was you defeat the army, you kill the soldiers, you take relatively few captives, and really the only people that you take as captives are people who make immediate conversion to Islam. So this sets the stage. If you can destroy the armies and kill soldiers, kill many soldiers from whoever's opposing you, it gives you an opportunity to seize political power, take control of the resources. And the early days of the Muslim conquest, there was a lot of focus on the Muslim side about providing basically competent government. The Muslim forces at the time were not corrupt. They battled corruption. The Quran had very rigorous things to say about why corruption was evil. So they worked hard to do that. And they approached this from the standpoint that if we can get military control and then political control, eventually people are going to all join our religion. And we don't have to do that right away because it will happen. It's inevitable. And so this is a conquest that has very much a long view. The military conquest leads to political and then economic control and then to full religious conversion eventually. And so this is the end of the Roman domination of Judea, the Roman domination of Egypt after centuries comes to an end. And And part of this is because there is the people of the West are divided in a lot of ways. There's division as a result of the Council of Chalcedon, where there was division between the church in the East and the church in the West about the natures of Jesus and what did that mean. There was significant division further west between those who were loyal to the emperor at Constantinople and those who opposed him, or those who thought that they, you know, he can't tell me what to do. And there was a lot of people in the church who believed that, you know, the Christian victory is inevitable. So whatever these Arab guys coming out of the desert are doing, you don't have to take them very seriously because the Christian victory is inevitable. God has said that we will be victorious, and therefore it is not necessary to do that much to repel these invaders. And so the Vandal Kingdom of North Africa is largely destroyed by the expansion of the empire under Justinian in the previous century. And so a whole lot of this area out here is relatively unpopulated and pretty easy to conquer. The Visigoth kingdom in Iberia does not prove to be terribly resistant to conquest either. But great centers of the church, Alexandria, great center of the church, Antioch, Jerusalem, Ctesiphon in Mesopotamia has become a great center of the church. Edessa, all these are places that have been important in the church from the first through the sixth centuries. And all these centers of the church fall under Muslim rule. And even Constantinople is threatened. And one of the reasons that happens, by the way, is there are a lot of people, particularly people in the church, who believe that the Muslim rule is an improvement. These are invaders. One of the reasons why Egypt falls so quickly is people in Egypt, particularly many leaders in the church, think that the government in Constantinople is basically corrupt, the taxes are too high, they demand too much, they call for too many soldiers to go serve in the army. The Muslim guys are going to run things in a much better way. They're going to provide better services, they're not going to be corrupt. We're not going to have to pay bribes to get things done. They're not going to take away nearly as many people to go serve in their army. And so there is a degree to which, particularly in Egypt, the Christians as individuals and Christian institutions actually welcome this conquest, because they believe that it will wipe away corruption, it will end the excessive taxation. They are exhausted by what they feel are the unending wars against the Persians, which never seem to produce anything. They see the emperor as oppressive, particularly with respect to issues of theology. The church in Egypt has become the Coptic church and has some theological differences with Constantinople, and feels very much like Constantinople is always trying to beat them up and oppress them into getting in line, as opposed to letting them follow what they believe. And so the conquering Arab armies come across as competent and uncorrupted. And also post-conquest, do some things to encourage the continuation of learning, to foster the continuation of libraries and studies, at least for a while. And there is a period here where there's an intellectual flowering across North Africa. The advances in mathematics, algebra is invented in this period of time. And algebra, of course, is an Arabic name, actually. Astronomy and medicine, there are some advances in this. So in a period where these kingdoms of the Lombards in what is now Italy and of the Franks, where most people are illiterate, there remains in Egypt and Syria high levels of literacy, high levels of education. And so
So that those are some things that are going on as we think about the church in this era.